To another episode, Nerds Amalgamated. I am the DJ, and with me today, I have the lovely Jovial Professor.
That's the nicest thing you've ever said about me.
Really?
Don't expect anything in return, though. Look, I have a fiance. She's not sharing.
How have you been, Professor?
I'm good. Sorry to burst your bubble there, but I'm doing well.
Oh, what a crazy week it has been. Like, Taliban going all crazy, OnlyFans going all crazy.
Yeah, apparently the reason OnlyFans has decided to ban pornographic content is because they're having issues with the payment processes.
Yeah, yeah.
But the way they're doing it just feels like a big mistake. They're splitting off into two brands. OnlyFans is going to be the clean brand, and they're creating some only porn brand, which seems silly because I asked a couple of people I know who aren't all that internet savvy what OnlyFans means, and all of them thought it was a porn site. So I don't think their marketing department's up to snuff.
Oh, what's even more crazier is how people are saying, like, oh, this will disenfranchise a lot of sex workers. And I'm like, I don't really think so.
It's kind of just shoving the problem over to another site. But anyway, the COVID case numbers down south a bit, and it's not the greatest. Have you got your jab, DJ?
I haven't got my jab, but yeah, I've been seeing the numbers and, jeez Louise, man.
I feel like you should be pushing for that. You're a customer-facing job, and you're probably old enough to get the AZ and the Pfizer. So you should check out Jimmy Rees on YouTube.
I might wait for the Pfizer, actually, but yeah.
Well, up to you, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm booked in to get the Pfizer this week.
Nice, nice.
But, yeah. We should,
I was going to say, how long do you reckon before one of them hits the 1K mark in infections?
I'm hoping not, because Sydney's going down a bit today, and there's sort of that 2-week lead time before you see changes, because the incubation of COVID is about 2 weeks. So yeah. I'm hoping the anti-lockdown protests aren't going to cause too much of a spike in another 2 weeks, though.
Oh,
we'll see.
Yeah.
If it's any state, though, I'd put my money on New South Wales.
That's fair.
And hoping desperately that it doesn't get into Queensland.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Well. Anyway, so let's start off with a bit of...
Happier news, DJ. Happier news.
Yeah, let's start off with some positive news. You've got a story about some game development companies for Green Thumbs.
Yeah, so it's something that I've thought about in the past, but I've never seen any official material about it or any movements in the industry, that games are kind of a big carbon user. We had a discussion a couple of months ago, actually, about the power usage of the new consoles.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I feel like it's only in the past year or so that I've seen people seeming to take the carbon emissions of games pretty seriously. So I've got here a white paper from the UKIE, and it's called Green Games Guide. And I had a read through it the other night. What they want to do is basically get game developers to work on reducing their impact. So half of the document is basically talking about all of the usual, fly less, drive less, ride a bike, that sort of thing. And the suggestions about how businesses can use carbon neutral or lower carbon options. But the bit I'm most interested in is the games itself. So they go in and they talk about different distribution methods. There's a case study from Sony Interactive Entertainment. So they've done a research on the PS4, And based on their estimates, playing games is a fairly low carbon activity compared to other leisure. And they have a source that says that going to the cinema, which involves driving or taking the bus, is estimated at 2.4 kilograms of CO2 emissions per hour. But video games is 0.05 kilograms of CO2 emissions per hour. So we should all stay home and play video games.
But here's the thing, though. Like, they're trying to calculate through, like, what, the frames per energy wattage, if I'm not mistaken?
Not in this particular article, but there is a bit of a discussion about... there is actually stuff in this article about reducing the energy cost of each frame. So they have advice to optimize your code so that you are doing less with each frame. But I'll get back to that in a minute. The Sony case study also identifies that streaming using PlayStation Now, which I'm a little bit suspicious of because Sony owns PlayStation Now and it's a subscription, it's probably the best dollar value that they get. So can we trust that this is accurate? I hope so, but the article was done by as a doctoral thesis at the University of Surrey, Climate Change Implications of Gaming Products and Services by Jay Aslan, if you want to look this up for yourself. Otherwise, there's a summary in the Green Games Guide, which is available at gamesindustry.biz. We'll have links to that in the show notes. So if you play on PlayStation Now, the lowest carbon emissions are up to 4 to 5 hours of total gameplay compared to downloading the game, which obviously uses internet for your download to run the hard drive you're storing it on, and so on and so forth. Also, PlayStation Now runs a lot of your, runs the game in a data center, which could be more efficient than having your own discrete computer.
So, but wouldn't it also depend on the type of game you're playing? Like,
The power
usage on playing, let's say, Stardew Valley on the PlayStation would be totally different to, let's say, a game of FIFA or a game of Fortnite, for example.
It would, and you can kind of do a little unofficial test for yourself by taking a portable console like the Switch and comparing the performance you get from playing, say, Stardew Valley compared to playing Doom or The Witcher. The more detailed the game is, the more power it's going to use. It's harder to get actual numbers without special tools, but it's something you can do a little test for yourself. But they estimate that PlayStation Now, 20 hours of PlayStation Now is comparable to buying a physical disc. So if you're not going to play your game all that long, there's an argument to be made that maybe you shouldn't be buying a disc. I think most players will get 4 to 5 hours out of a lot of games, so downloading makes a lot of sense there. But
it would depend on the internet usage, wouldn't it? Like, let's say our internet, which is not really good, like, it takes long just to get the game running.
Well, of course, downloading on a slower internet connection will use more power, probably, because you're keeping the computer awake for longer. On the other hand, faster networks use more power anyway. I don't know the details of that. I think they've probably taken that into account. But then, so if you're only playing for a few hours, play with PlayStation Now. If you want to play for more than 4 or 5 hours, buy the game and download it. If you're going to play it for more than 20 hours, you can get away with buying the CD. But the other problem is with downloading the file size, as we were just mentioning, for games up to 5 gigabytes, Sony estimate that downloading has the lowest carbon emissions. For larger games, PlayStation Now has the lower emissions for a few hours, bringing that back to the first point. But they do point out that you can use PlayStation Now as a trial to decide if you like a game before you download it. And that would let you determine whether you actually want to download it and buy it, saving you money, hopefully, and also saving you from having to download and install a full game and take up all of that, all of those emissions. That was back from the PlayStation 4, although Aslan's study says that it's a great name, Aslan. not cite the old magic to me, yada, yada, yada. They point out that the power usage of the internet has halved every 2 years since 2000, which goes against my experience that higher power, well, higher speed LANs use more power. But anyway, they probably know better than I do. And that PlayStation Now might change in the future. So there's also sections there about, in the article, about how to work within your business to reduce your carbon emissions, and a process they suggest to go through identifying weak points and then reducing and reviewing, so on and so forth.
So in terms of game development, is this going to be a benefit or a curse for game developers? I mean, it's good, like, we're seeing this sort of metrics and the facts to us. It's good to get those facts, but then how will it benefit the game developers in a big picture sense?
So, as an individual user, you're probably not going to think about this at all. Like, I don't look at a game I want to buy and think, am I saving the environment by buying it online? I just look at the best price. But I think as a developer, there are things you can do in the office which apply to any office, using more efficient equipment, switching it off when you're not using it, flying less, because commercial flights are a pretty big deal for greenhouse emissions. And of course, buying offsets, you know, planting trees and stuff to offset the carbon emissions you're outputting. Although there is a carbon offset forest in California, which is on fire right now, completely negating the point.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. It was interesting you mentioned, because I remember a couple of years ago that someone wrote an article saying the best way to fight climate change, here are the options: sell your car, avoid flights, go vegetarian, and don't have kids.
Yeah, a lot of all of that makes sense. So even the most efficient aircraft engine is still only roughly as efficient as a car with a single passenger. That number is for the A380. It might have changed more recently, but you know, you are moving 300 people, but you're using the same emissions that it would take to drive 300 people.
Yeah.
Now, then there's the argument about embodied carbon, how much it takes to build a car versus a plane. I don't know. Don't think that's taken into account in the numbers that I've read.
Yeah.
And yeah, if we all stopped having kids, climate change would end. Well, not end, but greenhouse gas emissions would end in about 80 years. But the bit I'm really interested in is not the stuff about making your office more efficient, because that applies to everyone, but the stuff that applies specifically to the games industry and other software jobs. But it talks about working out how to make your game more energy efficient. So it suggests having a green coding group to assess changes that you can make, which I think is I was thinking even before I got to this part of the document that maybe that's something a company could do. They could hire a couple of developers whose job is to work on optimizing for energy use. Reuse assets. So apart from the embodied carbon in creating the asset, every time someone has to download the asset, then it's creating more carbon emissions. So if you can reuse assets across multiple levels and even multiple games, the Half-Life games are really good at this, actually. If you only, you have to own them through Steam, actually, but if you own Half-Life 2 on Steam and buy the episodes, it will only download what it needs to make the episodes, and it links it back to Half-Life 2 so that when you play the episodes, it's borrowing assets that are reused from the original installation.
Yeah, but wouldn't it just okay? Two questions. One, wouldn't it stifle the freedom of a game developer into, like, okay, let's say for example, Cyberpunk 2077. Let's say for example, it's still in development, and you bring in the green coding group. Okay, and then
I don't think a green coding group could have done any more damage than Cyberpunk 2077's devs already did.
No, but let's say in a parallel universe, Cyberpunk is still in development, like early development, and we brought in this new coding group. Let's say that, okay? Let's say for argument's sake, right? But okay, and they decide like, okay, we're gonna recycle these assets and stuff. Wouldn't that just start? Wouldn't that just go like, I think recycling assets is not a good idea in a sense.
Why would they say that?
What was it? Because I remember some people were saying like, okay, recycling assets is, it's stupid in terms of, wait, are you too lazy to create your new stuff?
I don't know who you're quoting, but they're an idiot. Game devs have been reusing assets literally forever. The original Mario reuses the shape of the cloud for the bush. It just changes the color. It's just that we're finally, you know, we had this time in the 2000s and 2010s where we had the computing power to make every asset unique, but we didn't have the concern about the carbon emissions from it.
Yeah.
But games still reused assets.
Okay.
There are even articles you can find calling out the COD games for reusing assets for buildings year after year, which, yes, it is less effort to reuse the asset, but I don't think it's actually lazy at all. I think it's smart. You can take an asset and remix it, even if you don't use the exact same asset. You can remix it and make an asset that's close but different and have a different feel to it without being completely lazy. As a good example, look at the first Halo game, where the second half of the game is remixes of the first half of the levels. Except for the final couple of levels, the second half of the game is basically playing back through the original levels that you've already played, but with different goals and slight differences.
Okay. And my second question would be, how would this green coding group affect the quality of a game? Like, let's say you make the best looking game with the best looking graphics, and the green coding groups go like, nah.
Okay,
you got to tone down the quality.
That's a concern I can see people having. I think it's not as much of a concern as they think, because it does actually have recommendations in this article about that. So it does say to adapt the game specifications for your audience's average setup. So you're running, you know, you're not pushing for a 3090. You're running, aiming at a 2060 or whatever the most common is. You can find that out by looking at the Steam Hardware Survey as a really good source for that, because everyone has Steam. But they also point out, don't include the 4K assets in your default install, because most people don't have 4K screens, and if you only install the assets that you're going to need, then you're saving hard drive space and the emissions from downloading. Minimize the amount of power going into off-screen objects. That's pretty common sense. We already try to do that.
Yeah.
Avoid having objects updating on every frame, so reduce calls on every frame when possible. That's more of an engine thing. Which the green coding group could work on without actually affecting the quality of the game. Determine your trade-offs between live calculations and value lookups. So older games all used value tables because they didn't have the computing power to do the calculations live. And the value table is basically you go through and pre-compute all of the expected results. And instead of having to do the maths every time, you just look it up. I'm not sure what the exact numbers there would be, but I think in a lot of cases you can get away with using a value lookup rather than a live calculation.
Mm.
And they also mention something that would not affect the user at all, end user, but to only load things that a particular user needs when you're developing the game. So an artist only needs the artist tools. They don't need the whole game engine that can run the full simulation. They just need to be able to model things and process them into the correct format for the game.
Which is understandable. I mean, if you're going to do a task, you have to do the task. Like, but then again, like, there's always the problem of, like, let's say, for example, the artist uses a Mac, for example, and needs to transfer some files from the Mac to the PC, and the PC is not compatible with the Mac stuff. So, yeah.
No, that's not what they're talking about there.
Okay.
So, as an example, when I was in uni, we were using Unity. Everyone had a full installation of that, even though they didn't really need it. Our artist would create stuff and then put it into the game, but had nothing to do with the actual game other than just putting the art into the game. So we had someone else laying out the maps, somebody else doing the coding. So the person laying out the maps and the person doing the coding would need a full install, but the artist just needs to be able to put it into a folder that the game can draw from. But at the time, the way we had it set up with Unity, we had to use a full installation. So there's another case study by the game Space, the developers Space Ape, who have worked out their footprint at cloud being 50% of cloud computing is 50% of their carbon footprint. So if they could find a way to completely do away with cloud computing, which is impossible, they could cut it by 50%. But if they could cut their cloud computing by 50%, maybe by, instead of running a continuous integration every 10 minutes, run it once a day, something along those lines, they could, you know, cut a quarter off their emissions.
Imagine the day when big tech decides to go, okay, for the safety of planet Earth and for climate change, we're going to revert everything back to 56K.
That'll never happen because the tech companies make more money with higher internet speeds.
Yeah.
But it is a funny thing to think about, and I do think there is an argument to be made for optimizing existing tech rather than creating new tech. And I kind of wonder sometimes what the industry would look like if we were all still stuck on 8-bit CPUs.
It reminds me of there used to be an old, I'm not sure whether you've seen the movie Iron Sky.
I remember reading about that when they were making it and being really excited to check it out and completely forgot about it.
The story is basically
Nazis
about,
on,
like,
the moon, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's one scene where they capture the soldier and there's and he's like, "What do you have on there?" It's a computer, an iPhone. It's like, "No, that's a computer." He's like, it's like his room's just a one big bulky box computer. I'm like, damn, man, talk about being over the times.
So that's a case where it's not true that old stuff is better. But rather than chasing the incremental improvements from, say, the GTX 2000 series to the 3000 series, what if we stretched out the 2000 series and wrote better software to push it harder? There's it would also come down to whether they do a die shrink, their process nodes, all sorts of complicated hardware stuff, but I think it's something worth looking into.
Yeah. There is one more thing I need to ask, though. Does the report ever say anything about game remasters? Like Halo, for example, they constantly always do a remaster of every one of their games.
No, they've only done one remaster of Halo. A better example would be Skyrim, 10th Anniversary Edition coming out this year.
I will never understand that. How is that possible?
That is the ultimate example of asset reuse. You're reusing your assets so much, you're really not changing anything at all.
Nah. But yeah, like with remasters, for example, like they would be taking a lot more carbon emissions and stuff as well, wouldn't they?
Why?
Just to try and keep the graphics more updated and stuff.
Not any more than making a new game. Like, I can run a DOS game on my computer right now. I'm pretty sure the DOS game will run with using less power by itself than the equivalent computer from 30 years ago. But my whole computer probably offsets that because even though I'm running it on a more efficient CPU, the CPU itself is so much bigger, there's more cores, so But if I took that game and remastered it into super HD 4K ray tracing, blah, blah, blah.
the whole works.
Yeah, I don't know how I'd do that to a 2D game from 30 years ago, but for the sake of the argument, that would push my computer harder using more power. But would it do more than if I made a brand new game pushing my computer the same amount? I don't think so.
Okay.
I think one more point I've got from this is about the games console's voluntary agreement. So in the European Commission, Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo have to meet certain guidelines. So there's time limits for automatic power down if you leave it sitting on its own and don't touch it. Power caps for how much power it's allowed to use when you're just watching a movie or going through the dashboard. Out of warranty repair service and providing information to help maintain their consoles. Now, what I really like about the latest gen of consoles and the one before is that they are decently easy for a person with to repair. Now, I have no way of getting the correct chips or resoldering them. Someone could do that with the right equipment, but I personally can't. But my fiance's family, I almost keep saying girlfriend. I've only been engaged for a few weeks, but a fiance's family have an Xbox One, just the one, I think. And that's a secondhand to begin with from a family friend who upgraded to a 1X or whatever it's called. The hard drive is Cactus. So I've brought it back with me from the last time I went to visit them, and I'm replacing the hard drive in there, which is complicated. I need to take the whole thing apart, but not too difficult. And hard drives are a wear item in consoles. I think of basically anything with a moving part is a wear item in a console. And I think chances are you're more likely to break the moving part than you are to break the silicon. And in this case, as far as I can tell, as long as I set the hard drive up with the correct format before I put it in, so format it to FAT32 or whatever the console expects, I need to do some more research and just double check. It's a much easier repair than it is for me to do the same thing to my original Xbox. Because with my original Xbox, I can't just swap the drive because it's got it's got DRM keys on it. Not really DRM, but the same sort of idea. The hard drive is keyed to the console, so I can't just swap it over. But the newer consoles, I can, which is wonderful. I can replace a wear item that will fail sooner or later with no hassle. And that keeps people from throwing their consoles away and creating e-waste. But what's amazing is that under the voluntary agreement, they reckon that they can save huge amounts of electricity compared to running older generations of hardware, even though they are improving graphics capability. So the latest generation of consoles has the same or lower power caps than last gen, even though they're more powerful. That's an example of what I was talking about with die shrinks and more efficient manufacturing. But yeah, I think that's everything from the white paper. So you got any more questions, DJ?
Okay, so with all these information that's been out there, so how long do you reckon before the games company starts implementing these recommendations?
They already are. So the UKIE has a program called Playing for the Planet. So every time I say UKIE, I want to start singing Old MacDonald.
E-I-E-I-O.
Don't give up your day job. But the UKIE has, they call it Playing for the Planet. The UN has Playing for the Planet. The UKIE wrote this paper to explain how to play for the planet.
Man, they really got to come up with better names than Play for the Planet. Like,
I like it, but that already has a big, a lot of people signed up for it. A lot of developers.
Google Stadia is in this.
Yeah, Google Stadia saves the most carbon emissions by nobody using it. Of course, that's not... Look, the Google Stadia is a flop because nobody's using it, and all of that hardware is going to go to waste. Yeah. But
yeah. I mean, I'm seeing the members list, and there are some impressive ones, like Ubisoft, for example, Unity, Supercell, for those who are curious, Supercell, the studio behind Clash of Titans, Sony Interactive, Niantic.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of big names there, and it's not just developers, it's also companies that run game stores. But these are the places where I'd expect to see these sorts of things implemented. And some of them are even actually working on sort of raising awareness, which I don't know who isn't aware, but it's not the worst thing you can do at this point.
Mm. So how long before we see more and more companies to try and push it? There is a handful of members have signed up. Like, how long before we let's say Nintendo or Activision Blizzard? Well, if once they get out of that storm.
Well, Nintendo is already doing the voluntary agreement, so I think it would be good to see them join the Playing for the Planet initiative. I am disappointed to not see people like Activision Blizzard and EA on the list. So there are some big names there, but they're all like double A names, not triple A names.
Soft is,
but you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
This has only been going for a year or two. Give it another few years and yeah.
Okay. Okay, what about the indie devs? You reckon the indie devs will follow suit, or you reckon they'll just go, nah, it'd be fine?
There are indie games that are part of this group, and they are following the requirements as far as I'm aware. Like, there's even some... They have a green game jam. There's too many duh sounds. But, if you look at that, you can see a bunch of indie games there.
Ah, interesting. So Ghost Recon and Angry Birds 2. Who knew?
Yeah.
And okay, these games are all like America-based games. Like, what about games like, for example, from Japan or...
No, they're not. Angry Birds is by Rovio, who are from Sweden.
Okay, fair enough. Okay.
So that's literally the first option I see there. Ubisoft's head office is in France.
Okay, I get that.
90% sure, anyway. I know, like, they have offices in Canada, probably the US, but I think their main office is France.
Their main headquarters is in France, you're right.
Yeah, so it's not just a US initiative. Actually, it seems to be a lot of European stuff in here.
Yeah.
The voluntary agreement, a lot of the companies signed up for this are based in Europe.
I think there are a couple from China, which is funny. Like, China, one of the biggest polluters on the planet.
They are, but mostly because we made them.
Yeah, yeah.
The clever lie that has been recycling and offshoring industry to reduce the greenhouse emissions in third world countries has been dumping it all on third world countries. And that's why their numbers look so bad.
Mm-hmm.
But China is definitely pushing for green. They build tons of green power sources.
Yeah, hence that's why they're getting better computers than us.
I still can't get over how blatant that was. Hackers don't have better computers, and you don't want to... They're advertising better computers so people can hack better. Why? It hurts my soul.
Anyways, in the interest of time, we should move on. Speaking of hackers, a new study has highlighted that more than 80% of all hacking-related breaches happen due to compromised and weak credentials, with 3 billion username and password combinations stolen in 2016 alone.
That's true. The easiest way to hack someone is to just work out their password. In fact, I don't know if it's still online, but back in, what was it, 2013? Adobe got hacked, and what we ended up with was hash, which let us know how many letters the password was and the password hints. And somebody made a crossword of hacked passwords.
Oh, I see it. I see it. They made a list. So, such as, there were a couple such as QWERTY, 123, 123. I love you. Let me in.
The easy level is just embarrassing.
Oh, here we go. So there's 123456, 123456789, password Adobe 123, Photoshop, Macromedia, Azoti, all A's, 654321.
Yeah, I think the UI looks different, but it has been several years, so I think I found the crossword or one very similar.
So the implementation of the two-factor authentication, which aims to provide an additional layer, has become a necessity because of that. And it works too because this authentication has blocked 99% of all the automated attacks.
Yeah, SMS, turns out, is awful for a two-factor authentication, because there's a common attack called simjacking, where you basically go to the phone provider and ask them to transfer the phone number to a new SIM, steal the phone number, and then use it to breach someone's 2FA, because they just don't verify your identity well enough.
Yeah, they call it SIM swapping as well. That's the other name. And one of the tools they use is called Modlishka, which is leveraging a technique called reverse proxy, and this facilitates communication between the victim and the service being impersonated. So, in the case of Modlishka, it will intercept communication between a genuine service and a victim, and will track and record the victim's interaction with the service, including any login credentials it may use. So if an attacker has access to your credentials and manages to log into your Google Play account on a laptop, they can then install any app and they will likely automatically install that app onto your smartphone.
I am constantly amazed at the ingenuity of hackers.
And I'm surprised how the hackers are so fast in these responses. Like, the companies are not they're not really paying attention to it. They're like, oh, it's getting there. We'll take our own time.
Yeah, a lot of companies don't take cybersecurity seriously until they get hacked, and by then it's too late.
Yep, and then they get ransomed, and some of them do pay the ransom, even though they're not supposed to.
Yes, legally you're not supposed to. People are going to do it anyway.
So what's the alternative? So to be protected online, just check your initial line of defense is secure. Check your password. If it's compromised, there are a number of security programs that will let you do this.
The best one, and the one that every other source is based on, as far as I'm aware, is Have I Been Pwned? The URL is literally haveibeenpwned.com. It's run by a security researcher who has constantly proven that he is on the level. So you can feel safe putting your stuff in there. You shouldn't put in a password that you are already using, but just in case someone does a man-in-the-middle attack and manages to catch your password as you send it to Have I Been Pwned. But they have a really good service. If you prove that you own an email address, they will tell you if your account details show up in any breaches.
Okay, I put in one of my email addresses and it's saying that, yes, I have been, yeah.
Okay, so it'll tell you which breach that is and how long ago that was. And that can give you an idea of whether you should change your password or not. So, you know, if you've changed your password since that's happened, you should be fine. Unless your password is just old password plus one, or with a one at the end or something.
Mm-hmm.
God, it hurts. I work in IT, and sometimes people give me their passwords. They shouldn't, but they do, and it hurts when the password is like January 123. I'm like, yes, it technically gets around the password requirements, but no. We have certain password requirements that are mandated because of the type of business we are, and unfortunately, the way it's configured, I'm not actually in charge of that, but I did raise an issue to get it fixed. If it's possible, I'm not really sure. But yeah, technically, with all the requirements, you know, capital letters, lowercases, 10 letters long, special characters, something like January 123 exclamation mark would pass. But it's not a good password. Nobody use it, please. Because hackers will try to log into your account and they will run a software that checks 100 passwords a minute, and they will do it until they get in using stuff like that. They don't try to guess what your password is. They just hope that you are one of the people who has used such a dumb password.
Oh, man.
And, you know, really sorry if anyone who uses that as a password hears this, but please change it.
Okay, but what about those people that have, like, sophisticated malware?
They are a completely different kind of threat. People who want to hack you will eventually get in sooner or later. The best you can do is reduce your vulnerability to it so that nobody wants to hack you. By improving the security of your business or your service, whatever you're running, you change your threat model from bored teenager in the basement to government hackers. And so you kind of want to be as secure as possible so that the only people coming after you are like government hackers, because we all know about Russian hackers and Chinese hackers.
Oh, yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if there are Australian hackers. We just don't hear about them. but they won't be interested in hacking you because you're not a target for them. But eventually there will, I don't mean to discourage people, but eventually there will be a breach. But the more you do to protect yourself means that the less likely it is to happen and the less you will lose when it does happen.
This article, interestingly enough, said that an alternative for that is to use a dedicated hardware device known as a YubiKey.
Yeah, so we're in two-factor authentication, or multi-factor authentication. There are different factors. What we refer to the three main factors are something you are, so your fingerprint, your retina scan, something you know, your password, and something you have, which is your key card. So a proper two-factor, something you have in most cases is your phone number, but that's not really secure because it's so easy to steal someone's phone number. So something like Google Authenticator is more secure because it uses encryption and it's harder for someone to get their hands on it than it is for them to simjack you. Something you have is your key card or your YubiKey. If you work at like a top secret government lab and you have to swipe your key card to get in and then scan your eyeball and then put in a password, that's three factors, which is super secure because a hacker has to steal your key card, steal your eyeball, and steal your password. It's a game of
chance.
Well, no, it's a game of making it not worth the effort for someone to hack you.
Okay, but what about those devices? Like, I remember once some banks would offer this. Like, there'd be a little device.
Oh, the RSA keys?
Yeah, those ones with
that's
the numbers.
That's something you have.
RSA keys?
Yeah. So in that case, the RSA key is synchronized to the home server, but has no, like, mobile connection in it. It just has a very accurate clock, and it generates a new password every minute or so. The goal there is that someone trying to hack your account needs to know your password and have your key. And because the code on the key changes every minute, if they see your key and steal your password, they have to get in within a minute or so. It's not something that someone can look at, run away, and do the next day.
Yeah.
That would be under a something you know because you have to enter your password, and a something you have because you have the token.
Yeah, essentially these methods need to go beyond the two-factor and towards a multi-factor authentication environment where multiple methods of authentication are simultaneously deployed. But here's my question with a multiple factor authentication, okay? Wouldn't that, like a two-factor authentication, okay, it's minimal, you don't need to, like, you don't need to stress too much. But with a multi-factor, you're kind of opening yourself to a lot more, like, yeah, sure, you do have more protection, but at the same time, there's more ways to go through it, like a facial recognition, for example. Like people can fool that, for example, or a voice recognition as well. People can fool that as well, you know.
Yes, but properly done, it is significantly harder to fool. The problem with passwords is that if you just use a password and you write it down somewhere or someone sees you typing it in, they can go and get in, no questions asked. But the goal of using your voice ID or your fingerprint is that it's something you have, which someone can't take away from you without more effort. With a voice ID, maybe they could record you, maybe they could get someone who sounds like you. With a fingerprint, they need to chop off your finger or somehow replicate your fingerprint. Which, not impossible, but you're just raising the bar.
Yeah. So in other words, it creates more effort for the bad guy, for example.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the goal is to make more effort for the bad guy so that they can't be bothered hacking you.
So for our final topic, we have the story of Hotel Transylvania and how it's moving its theatrical run to go for the streaming option on Amazon Prime.
Plenty of room at the Hotel Transylvania.
Oh, man. So this decision to skip the theaters and head to Prime Video with the CG animated pick is understood to be in the early stage and could result in a deal of around $100 million.
Yeah, we I had an interesting thought about this when you brought it up the other night.
Yeah.
That it used to be, so this is Hotel Transylvania 4. I'm not expecting any, you know, groundbreaking movie. I mean, most kids' movies by the fourth movie in the series aren't great anymore. Shrek pulled it off. Yeah. The fourth Shrek is pretty good. But so I'm not expecting anything, you know, mind-blowing. But it did get me thinking, lots of movies are going to streaming now. And up until the last year, it was pretty much a sign that if a movie went straight to DVD or straight to streaming, it was going to be shit.
or it was reduced to, we'll see you at the afternoon, at lunchtime, on a horrible TV channel. But yeah, because of COVID, like it changed the game in terms of streaming services have exploded. And yeah, we're seeing a lot of simultaneous releases. And I will say this, okay? It's a nice idea, but the problem when you put a film onto when you put the film into the internet, you can bet your money it'll be on the high seas within a matter of hours.
Yeah, which is why they try to make it hard by using things like HTTP and other tools. I've noticed, I was watching a show on Netflix recently and noticed a cameo I wanted to point out to my friends. Couldn't screenshot it. It would only come up as a black screen. Mm-hmm. So they try to make it harder. I probably could have gotten around with it if I'd cared. But in fact, I wonder if OBS could do that. I probably shouldn't be doing this live and telling people how to hack it. But
we could just say, okay, we must warn you. If you do this, the cops will find out.
You wouldn't download a car.
Oh, remember those those ads were insane.
I love the IT Crowd parody. You wouldn't steal a policeman's hat, shoot a policeman, and steal his hat, and use the hat as a bathroom, and send the hat to his widow, and then steal it again.
Oh, those were good. Those were funny.
Yeah, So it's not, you know, not impossible to pirate a movie that comes out on streaming, but it's not the hardest either. You can probably get a movie that's released on streaming cheaper, well, not cheaper, sorry, in higher quality than you would from a traditional cam rip.
Yeah.
Like back in the day when people used to sneak cameras into movie theaters.
I remember, I don't know whether you remember this, but when The Simpsons movie came out, some idiot decided to take a camcorder in it, record the whole movie, and post it up on YouTube. Everybody went nuts after that.
Okay, so OBS can't do it. I'm sure there's a hacked version of OBS or something that will do it, though.
Here's the sad part, right? Like, companies are now accepting the whole let's put this into the simultaneous releasing onto the apps, because they've decided, okay, we need money. Like,
because of the thin margins.
The thin margins. But yeah, I think they decided, like, you know what, because of this unspecified virus of unknown origin, we're going to, like, put this onto the internet services. And I think the reason why they're doing the whole streaming thing, because they found that it's the fastest way to get money off from people. Because
I think it's the only way.
Yeah, it's the only way.
Because the cinemas have been closed for, you know, off and on in Australia, but in other places they've been closed for, you know, 18 months now.
Yeah.
So I think they're deciding that the only way to make money on this investment right now is to release on streaming.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, you can't afford to put a multi-million dollar movie in the can and wait for hope to God, like, the theaters will reopen. Like, assuming that there are any of the theaters left, not only do you lose the momentum and public interest for the people to promote the movie, people will gradually forget about this.
Yeah, and then, you gotta deal with marketing.
Yeah.
So I expect when movies start going back to cinemas, there will be huge marketing pushes to remind people. We're already kind of seeing that with the movies that go to streaming.
Yeah, yeah. And not to mention, like, and if they can't afford the marketing, they have to rack up huge debts. I mean, the films don't finance it by themselves, funnily enough. They don't tend to have millions of dollars lying around in the wake. Like, they take out multiple loans from investors. And the thing about these loans, you have to pay them back. I mean, most of the time...
Makes sense that they're going to try to make their money back.
Yeah, and you have to start paying the interest right away. And the longer you leave that loan outstanding, the more interest you have to incur. And if you try and duck them away, they'll send their debt collectors to break your fingers, basically.
But it's Hollywood, so they never pay any interest because they never actually technically made money.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think it's something to... So what I really wanted to talk about, though, was that the quality shift. So, like I said, it used to be if you go straight to streaming, it's rubbish. But now all of the good movies coming out on streaming, what do we do? How do we categorize them? How do we know if a movie's shit or not? I can't handle it.
I think it will come down to two things. How terrible the movie's written. I mean, look at Wonder Woman 1984, for example. When that movie came out on streaming services, man, that movie was shit.
It still did pretty well.
Oh, come on. It still did pretty well. Yeah, sure. How much debt did it incur just to get that movie out? Like, how many times was it delayed as well? And not to mention, like, with the recent movie of Black Widow, Disney has a couple of actors have decided, you know what? We're being ripped off here.
Yeah, because their contracts say cinema takings, and knowing Hollywood, I wouldn't be surprised if they're saying that it came out on streaming, not in the cinema, so you don't get anything.
But the interesting you mentioned that, because here's the thing, like, it's funny you mention that, because believe it or not, studios do care about making money. Well, with not that you think so with all the movies that's been churning out lately. And the longer you wait for the movies, the more debt they rack up and the less chance they'd be likely to make a profit.
Are you saying that it's the same thing that's happened to just about every business in the last 18 months? Can't make money because it's closed. At least movies have a way out.
But the way out's kind of like, it's broken in a sense.
I'm happy for it. I'm perfectly happy to go to a mixed release schedule in the future. Have movies release at home and in cinemas.
Okay,
because I would like in the future to be able to decide whether I want to see a movie in person or at home lying on my bed. Now, the movie theater is going to be a bigger screen and better sound system than most people have at home. So most people are probably still going to go there. But a movie like A Quiet Place, where all the suspense is the quiet, I don't want to hear people talking in the movie. So I want to have that option.
But the problem would be that, I get where you're coming from. Like, you would watch a movie in cinemas and and online as well. But the problem would be is, how would you tighten the leash in terms of people trying to sail the high seas, if you get what I mean?
I wouldn't. I wouldn't try to stop people pirating, because you can't. I would make it easier for people to access the movies, because in the games industry, it's been known for a long time that piracy is a service problem, not a people problem. People will pay for games if you let them. Of course, there's a certain fraction of people who will pirate anyway. But if I can find a movie on Netflix, I don't have a reason to pirate it. I have a Netflix account. I think, actually, they're shooting themselves in the foot. I know having more options is better for competition, but I think having literally every company split off to their own streaming service is shooting themselves in the foot, because now you're going to have more difficulty finding the movie. You need to sign up for a separate service. It's a whole bunch of friction. And the more friction you put in front of someone, the more likely they are to pirate. So I don't think adding DRM or chasing pirates is the way to go. I think the way to go is to work on fixing the streaming services.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you there. Yeah, I agree. I agree, and I think it will take a very long time, because with the current model and how broken it is, it's going to be a while before they change the pricing structures and whatnot. So, yeah,
I just think that they shouldn't be trying to screw over their actors, and they should still be paying them, even though it's going to home releases, because the actors still worked. On one hand, when I see this, I'm like, you got paid $20 million to be in the movie, get over it. But on the other hand, I see Disney, the evil company, because we all know the mouse is evil, exploiting people, and I don't like that either.
Yeah.
I'd rather the actors get paid what they deserve than Disney exploit people and use it as an excuse to make even more money so they can suppress the public domain even further.
Curiously, though, you saw the Mulan movie, right?
No.
Okay. Because I remember, like, some of the movies were released for free.
You say that like it's a question?
They were released for free, I think. Yeah, they were released for free. And my question would be, like, do you reckon, like, releasing movies for free, even though they made, like, a lot of money, they used a lot of money to make the dang thing, is a good idea?
Well, releasing for free obviously doesn't make you any money directly. But it does get people onto your service. And once you have them on your service, they're more likely to stay there. Like I said, friction. People, and also inertia, people don't like change. It's why just about every subscription service in the world, gyms, insurance, etc., offers new user sign-up bonuses. They don't ever give it out to the people who have been there for 10 years, because the people who have been there for 10 years are still going to pay, but the goal is to get new people in to increase the money you're making.
Yeah.
And the reason that's viable is because people are too lazy to change, or too busy, or don't have the energy. It's, yeah.
Right. Fair enough. Anyways, we'll take a short break and we'll be back with the shout-outs, remembrances, famous birthdays, and events of interest.
This podcast is brought to you by whoever it puts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so on to our shout-out. So on the 15th of August, we passed the 35th anniversary of Starflight, an open-world exploration, combat, and trading RPG by Binary Systems. It's first released on the IBM PCs and later on most home computer brands. The player, a starship captain, is able to mine, fight, and conduct diplomacy with procedurally generated alien species. A doomsday plot is about a threat that could destroy all life unwinds, but the player is free to do whatever they want. Clearly, the developers of Mass Effect were paying attention. The director of Mass Effect even admitted that it was a big inspiration. The game took 15-man years across the 3 actual years to be developed. Impressively, the procedural generation is about to create an entire universe with only 128K of RAM. The fractal generator allowed the game to feature 800 planets, and the procedural generated life forms inspired Dwarf Fortress Forgotten Beasts. That's impressive.
And right now, it's available for like $1 on GOG.
Oh, yeah.
I looked it up the other day to find out if it was available on Abandonia or anything. Turns out GOG has gone and put it together in a package so it runs on modern systems. And it's currently on sale for $1. It doesn't say when that will end, but, you know, it's both games in the series for 75% off right now. So pretty cheap even when it's not on sale.
Yeah. Interestingly, this game reminds me of another space RPG game. I don't know whether you're familiar with this. It's called Freelancer.
Yes, I haven't played that one, but I do know of it.
Yeah, I saw the box art for that, and it was saying, like, fight, mine, and do crazy things. This is a space exploration game. I'm going to try that at some point. Although, I will say
that guy looks like Mal Reynolds. That even looks like the nose of Fire of Serenity. I do actually have that because I got a while back a package of all of the Descent games.
Yeah.
Or maybe just the two, actually, Descent and Free Space. There's more of them, I'm pretty sure. But I have played Descent, but never got to Free Space.
We'll be putting in the GOG offer on our show notes, so feel free to check it out. And
yes, hopefully it's still going by the time we get there.
Yeah. So moving along, a panda in Singapore gave birth on the 10th of August, bringing the total of 3 captive pandas born in the past few weeks. The parents, Kai Kai and Jia Jia, are due to finish their 10-year loan from China next year.
Wonderful news. Everyone loves pandas.
What's interesting is how, like, one week, one panda. Next week, another panda. If we could get another panda next week, that'd be amazing.
Well, this was only one birth, though, so we'd have to have half a panda because it's obviously halving each time.
On the 17th of August, the creator of the puzzle Sudoku passed away at 69. Maki Kaiji wanted to make a puzzle for children and people who didn't want to think too hard. He originally named it Tsujiwa Dokushin ni Kairu, which means numbers should be single, a bachelor. Honestly, these translations.
I say that is a mouthful. Like, even in Japanese. Tsujiwa Dokushin ni Kairu. Like, I'm happy it's Sudoku.
The current name, formed from the Japanese words for numbers and single, is much less of a mouthful. Kaiji was also called the grandfather of Sudoku.
Which is odd, like, does that imply there is a father of Sudoku? I don't know, that was a weird, line in the article, but...
I know, it's... Grandfather of Sudoku. Oh. So, a day later, we passed the 15th anniversary of Snakes on a Plane. The title kind of gives away the entire concept. The writer, David D'Alessandro, was inspired by news articles about brown tree snakes climbing in the aircraft during World War II. He originally featured a single brown tree snake, but was inspired by aliens to add boar snakes. That's like, hey, I saw an alien the other day. Let's add boar snakes. Good thing
it worked.
Yeah. I mean, good thing it was aliens and not Jaws. So, filming used more
but
than...
But can you imagine Jaws with more sharks, though?
Oh, no. Oh, we actually, Sharknado.
Yeah, that's close enough.
So, filming used more than 450 snakes, but most of the final film used animatronics and CGI. Each snake had a production name, which could have made the credits a little long. really long. Samuel Jackson required his contract to include the 8-meter social distancing clause just to keep the snakes away from him.
Not everybody likes it.
And I also remember, like, originally he didn't want to put snakes on a plane. And then Samuel Jackson, like, they changed the name because of marketing or something. And then Samuel Jackson said, nah, screw you. If you don't change the name. If you change the name, I'm out of this film project. And they decided to go back with Snakes on a Plane.
It works.
Oh, yeah. So, remembrances. So, on the 17th of August, 2012, Victor Poor, developer of the Intel 808 processor, passed away. He worked at Computer Terminal Corporation, who produced the first personal computer, the DataPoint 2200, programmable terminal using the 808. Poor and an amateur radio colleague, Harry Pyle, hey, PNP, produced the underlying architecture of the 808 on a living room floor. Their friend, Jonathan Schmidt, wrote communication software for their chip. They pitched the design to Texas Instruments and Intel with encouragement from their founders of CTC. He also oversaw development of ARCNET, an early LAN project. Poor died at 79 in Florida. And no, he did not die poorly.
That was terrible.
So, onto our famous birthdays. On the same day in 1896, Leslie Richard Groves Jr. was born. He oversaw the construction of the Pentagon and directed almost every aspect of the Manhattan Project. He was one dressed down by Eisenhower, who was then Army Chief of Staff, General of the Army, and told he would never become Chief of Engineers. Although he never became Chief, leading the Manhattan Project had to be a good way of proving your worth. And I bet you, imagine working at the Manhattan Project. How much did that mentally screw you up afterwards?
Well, there is the famous I've become deaf destroyer of worlds line, but I'm not aware of any of the people working on the project actually being that traumatized. Like, they acknowledged that what they did was extreme, but it was to win an extreme war, so...
I remember Einstein was very depressed after that.
Yeah, a few people were. They were... You know, they're pretty upset that, you know, they worked on creating something so destructive. But at the same time, they joined the Manhattan Project because they wanted to see the war end. And they didn't want Germany to get it first, which Germany made the lovely mistake of chasing away all the Jewish scientists who then went on to work in the Manhattan Project.
Wait, wasn't Operation Paperclip a thing during that time as well?
No, that was after the war.
Okay.
I'm not aware of any paperclip scientists who... worked on the Manhattan Project.
Okay, cool. So, on to our events of interest. In 1978, Ben Abruzzo, Maxie Anderson, and Larry Newman completed the first hot air balloon crossing the Atlantic in the Double Eagle 2. It took them 137 hours and 6 minutes to travel from Presque Isle, USA, and to Misery. Man, it's so... The pronouncing is so wrong. France. where they touched down on the 17th of August. Newman planned to hang glide out of the balloon, but had to dump his hang glider as ballast. Authorities planned to receive them at Le Bourget Airfield, where Charles Lindbergh had landed, but the crew declined as it was too risky to cross populated suburbs. The men had to draw to decide who would sleep in the same bed that Lindbergh had used in the U.S. Embassy, with Newman winning. The men and their spouses were given a free ride in a Concorde back to the U.S. Man, could you imagine being the guy who won the bed?
That would be pretty cool.
It's like, yoo-hoo, I won Charles Lindbergh's bed! Although it'd be pretty musty, though.
I assume they've changed the sheets sometime in the 30 years or 40 years or whatever it was.
Rare. Finally, on the same day in 1939, Buck Rogers, the serial, was released in Portugal. The well-known character was a 20th century pilot who, along with a friend, was transported 500 years in the future via suspended animation. In the original comic, Buck was a World War I pilot. For some reason, almost every element was changed while keeping the basic plot. Possibly this version of the story was actually based on a piece of unofficial published Flash Gordon fanfic. After this release, the comic revisited Buck's origin, stating that Buck was searching for a meteor for use in spaceship construction, only for gas contained in the meteor to knock him out for 500 years. Did you ever like that? Did you ever like the story, though?
I actually haven't seen Buck Rogers.
Yeah, for me, I'm more familiar with the parody edition, which is Duck Dodgers and the Hero of the 24th Century.
What's that from?
That's actually from Warner Brothers. Hang on a second. Yeah, that's right. Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century. It was a classic Warner Brothers cartoon. But anyways, that's all we have for this week. Where can they find us, Professor?
Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, everywhere.
They can also find us on thatsnotcanada.com, where we have an archive of our old episodes. And you can find some new podcasts as well, such as Cast Party. So, quiet on the set, we're rolling in 3, 2, welcome to Cast Party, a Dungeons & Dragons podcast thrust into the world of D&D for cast and crew members from a Hollywood film set to find themselves with new powers in very new places on an adventure none of them actually knew how to process. Follow along as our director, Colin McManus, leads our cast and crew consisting of Ryan McManus, Anna Brisbane, Nigel Deacon, and Vince Perino through this gripping and hilarious story.
So it's actors getting transported into D&D, is it?
Yep.
Wow, this might be fun to check out.
Yeah.
Do we know who the cast are?
I think I read them initially, but second. So it's director Colin McManus.
Oh, okay. I thought those were character names.
Right. Okay, cool. That's fair. So, anyways, take care of each other, look after yourselves, and stay hydrated.
We'll see you next week. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.